Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Richard Russo. Richard Russo has published 6 novels, one of which, Empire Falls, won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for Literature. His other novels include Mohawk, The Risk Pool, Nobody's Fool, Straight Man, and Bridge of Sighs. He has also published a collection of short stories, The Horse Child, and other stories. He's visiting Pittsburgh as part of the Drew Heinz Lecture Series. He has 2 grown daughters and lives in coastal Maine with his wife. He'll be reading tonight from Bridge of Sighs, which is out in paperback from Vintage Books. Hi, Richard. Welcome to Prosody.
It's good to be here.
Could you start off by reading a little bit from Bridge of Sighs?
Sure.
Great.
First, the facts. My name is Lewis Charles Lynch. I'm 60 years old, and for nearly 40 of those years, I've been a devoted, if not terribly exciting, husband to the same lovely woman, as well as a doting father to Owen, our son, who is now himself a grown married man. He and his wife are childless and likely, alas, to so remain. Earlier in my marriage, it appeared as if we would be blessed with a daughter, but a car accident when my wife was in her 4th month caused her to miscarry. That was a long time ago. But Sarah still thinks about the child, and so do I. Perhaps what's most remarkable about my life is that I've lived all of it in the same small town in upstate New York, a thing unheard of in this day and age. My wife's parents moved here when she was little, so she has few memories before Thomaston, and her situation isn't really much different from my own. Some people, upon learning how we've lived our lives, are unable to conceal their chagrin on our behalf, that our lives should be so limited, as if experience so geographically circumscribed could be neither rich nor satisfying. When I assure them that it has been both, their smile suggests that we have been blessed with self-deception by way of compensation for all we've missed. I remind such people that until fairly recently, the vast majority of humans have been circumscribed in precisely this manner, and that lives can also be constrained by a great many other things. Want, illness, ignorance, loneliness, and lack of faith, just to name a few. But it's probably true my wife would have traveled more if she'd married someone else, and my unwillingness to become the vagabond is just one of the many ways that I have been, as I said, an unexciting, if loyal, and unwavering companion. She's heard all my arguments, philosophical and other, for staying put. In her mind, they all amount to little more than my natural inclination. Inertia, rationalized. She may be right. That said, I don't think Sarah has been unhappy in our marriage. She loves me and our son and, I think, our life. She assured me of this not long ago when it appeared she might lose her own, and sick with worry, I asked if she regretted the good, simple life we've made together. Though our pace, never breakneck, has slowed recently, I like to think that the real reason we've not seen more of the world is that Thomaston itself has always been both luxuriant and demanding. In addition to the corner store we inherited from my parents, we now own and operate 2 other convenience stores. My son, Riley, refers to these as the Lynch Empire. And while the demands of running them are not overwhelming, they are relentless and time-consuming. Each is like a pet that refuses to be housebroken and resents being left alone. In addition to these demands on my time, I also serve on a great many committees, so many, in fact, that late in life I've acquired a nickname, Mr. Mayor. A tribute to my civic-mindedness that contains, I'm well aware, an element of gentle derision. Sarah believes that people take advantage of my good nature, my willingness to listen carefully to everyone even after it's become clear that they have nothing to say. She worries that I often return home late in the evening and then not in the best of humors, a natural result of the fact that the civic pie we divide grows smaller each year, even as our community's needs continue dutifully to grow. Every year, the arguments over how we spend our diminished and diminishing assets become less civil, less respectful, and my wife believes it's high time for younger men to shoulder their fair share of the responsibility, not to mention the attendant abuse. In principle, I heartily agree, though in practice, I no sooner resign from one committee than I'm persuaded to join another, and Sarah's no one to talk, serving as she has until her recent illness on far too many boards and development committees. Be all that as it may, our well-established rhythms of our adult lives will soon be interrupted most violently, For, despite my inclination to stay put, we are soon to travel, my wife and I. I have but 1 month to prepare for this momentous change and mentally adjust to the loss of my precious routines, my rounds, I call them, that take me to every part of our town on an almost daily basis. Too little time, I maintain, for a man so set in his ways, but I've agreed to all of it. I've had my passport photo taken, filled out my application at the post office, and mailed in all the necessary documents to the State Department, all under the watchful eye of my wife and son, who seem to believe that my lifelong aversion to travel might actually cause me to sabotage our plans. Owen, in particular, sustains this unkind view of his father, as if I would deny his mother anything, after all she's been through. "Watch him, Ma," he advises, narrowing his eyes at me in what I hope is mock suspicion. "You know how he is." Italy. We will go to Italy. Rome, then Florence, and finally Venice. No sooner did I agree than we were marooned in a sea of guidebooks that my wife now studies like a madwoman. "Acqua Alta," she said last night after we'd finally turned off the light, her voice near and intimate in the dark. She found my hand and gave it a squeeze under the covers. "In Venice, there's something called Acqua Alta, high water." "How high?" I said. "The Calais flood." "What's a Calais?" "If you would do some reading," she said, "you'd know that the streets in Italy are called Calais." "How many of us need to know that?" I asked her. "You're going to be there, right? I'm not going alone, am I?" "When the Acqua Alta is bad," she said, "all of St. Mark's is underwater." "The whole church?" I said. "How tall is it?" She sighed loudly. "St. Mark's isn't a church. It's a plaza. The Plaza of San Marco. Do you need me to explain what a plaza is?" Actually, I had known that calles were streets and hadn't really needed an explanation for Acqua Alta either, but my militant ignorance on the subject of all things Italian has quickly become a game between us, one we both enjoy. "We may need boots," my wife ventured. "We have boots." "Rubber boots. Acqua Alta boots. They sound a siren." "If you don't have the right boots, they sound a siren," I said. She gave me a swift kick under the covers. "To warn you that the high water is coming, so you'll wear your boots." "Who lives like this?" I said. "Venetians." "Maybe I'll just sit in the car and wait for the water to recede." Another kick now. "No cars," she said. "Right. No cars." "Lou?" "No cars," I repeated. "Got it. Calles where the streets should be. No cars in the Calles, though. Not one." "We haven't heard back from Bobby," she said. "Our old friend. Our third musketeer from senior year of high school, long, long gone from us." She didn't have to tell me that we hadn't heard back. "Maybe he's moved," I said. "Maybe he doesn't live in Venice anymore." "Maybe," said my wife, "he'd rather not see us."
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Richard Russo. Richard, when I was getting ready for this interview, of course, I was checking out other interviews because that's the way us interviewers do this stuff. And one of the things I read was that at some point, I think it was when you were working on Nobody's Fool, you were talking with your agent about whether you were setting your stories in kind of similar terrain too much.
Yeah.
Small towns, yeah. You know, upstate New York where this book is set. And he told you not to worry about that people wanted to be able to enter a familiar world, something. And so what they were really looking for was what was recognizably Russo, I think
yeah.
is what he said.
Yeah.
And I just want to ask you, I know what I think recognizably Russo is, but I'm wondering what are the things that you pull in every time that you think helped to combat that, just talking about small towns?
Yeah, because it is tricky. The problem has always been to not write the same book over and over again. Even as you provide readers with something, as my agent suggested then, that is familiar. Mm-hmm. We're not upset with Dickens for returning to London in every book. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. You know, when he was writing Hard Times, that seemed to be a little out of his sphere in that book. So I had to find out what my terrain was, and small towns was part of it. The emphasis on relationships between parents and children was part of it. Fathers and sons in the beginning, but now really parents of all descriptions with children of all descriptions have gone from fathers and sons to fathers and daughters and mothers and sons. And in this book, Bridge of Sighs, has all kinds of familial relationships. But I also think of a Richard Russo novel now, especially these last few, as being novels in which you find yourself in the company of I hope people worth caring about, going into some fairly uncomfortable places, but always armed with humor. That much I learned from Mark Twain. My agent taught me a lot, but Mark Twain taught me a few things too. And that was kind of going to be the world that I was going to go into. It's a world that contains, at odd times, violence and racism and ignorance, but also human folly. And the right thing to do with human folly, of course, is to laugh at it.
Well, and there also seems to be a lot of, you know, the terrain that you talk about. You know, and for me, it's not just the landscape. I think, you know, that would, if you're just writing about a particular landscape, that might be something that would feel more redundant. Mm-hmm. But it's also about relationships. It's about history. It's about your sense of yourself. And the terrain, for me in the book, in a number of your works, it keeps shifting. At times it's claustrophobic. Just because of the fact that everybody knows what everybody else is doing, what their family has done, what the town has done, what's the history of practically everything. And so you're always, anything you do is always being put into that context. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this real depth because you have such a sense of yourself. And I mean, I think us as readers, we're bonding with the character. We have a sense of who they are. And the idea that the world has a sense of who you are beyond just your surface. That makes it both the good and the bad at the same time. So for me, you know, that's when I'm reading the book. And I noticed in this book that Louis or Lucy is in first person. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if that was part of the choice, you know, because it gives you a certain fluidity about trying to figure out at any given point what you think of yourself and what you think of your town, especially because we meet him. He's older in the very beginning, but we quickly flash back to when he's quite young.
Right. And Lucy, in this book, I think the danger of the claustrophobia that you point out was greater in this book than any of my others, because I don't think of Lucy's narrative as being 100% reliable. And because he has never left the town that he grew up in, he has a rather insular view of a lot of things, including his own experience of life. Mm-hmm. He's kind of swallowed the mythology of his town, but also of America whole from his father, that great post-war optimism that his father, Big Lou, believes in to the center of his soul, and that his mother is always trying to suggest to Lucy that his mileage may vary, as the mileage of many Americans vary. But there was the danger of claustrophobia with Lucy, which is why I was trying in this book to do a number of different things. One of the stories gets told in first person. The other two major stories get told in third person. Right. And as important as it was to live in the world of Thomaston, New York, and the even smaller world of Ikey Lubin's, it was also necessary just for our lungs, just to get different air in our lungs, to go to Venice for a while too, someplace I had never, you know, this far away. I had never traveled so far from my native turf in a book before.
Yeah, it's you know, there. I think that's one of the things with Lucy is, you know, because he states flat out that he's an optimist like his father.
Yeah,
his father, as you watch him, because he's an adult, you think of him as being not very realistic about what's happening. And I didn't think of his mom as a pessimist as much as a realist.
I think so, yeah.
You know, she kind of knows there's always the possibility that something bad can happen, but it's not like she's waiting for it to happen. She's, it seems like she's trying to make sure to stay on this side of that possibility.
I think she values the truth of her own experience.
Yeah.
Big Lou, God love him, is a myth maker. He loves myth. He loves the idea that in America, as he puts it, if you are hardworking and honest, you will prosper. And when they cross Division Street in this novel from the lower class West End to the slightly more affluent East End, he immediately, despite his own experience, despite what he knows is the reason for their crossing Division Street, he immediately accepts the mythology as the reason. He's been hardworking, they've been honest, and so they have prospered. It takes his wife to say, well, actually, we've crossed Division Street because I've borrowed money that my parents couldn't afford to give us so that we could cross Division Street. And because of a very bad thing that happened, not a good thing,
right,
that happened to our son. So I think you're right. I think that Tessa, one of the reasons that I love both of these characters, I love both the realist and the optimist. But they're coming at the world, and Lucy senses this right from the beginning. They're coming at the a world that he is going to have to understand from very, very different vantage points.
And I think by him identifying with his dad, but because he's so young, we kind of want him to stay optimistic when he's
a child.
Because, you know, we all know what happens down the road when you grow up and you face all these different kinds of challenges that his father's kind of blocking out. So you feel, as a reader, I felt really protective of him in the beginning. Like, boy, I hope this keeps going for a while.
Yeah.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Richard Russo. Richard, would you read some more?
Sure.
Great.
This is a novel about class. It's right in the forefront of this book. And what I found, one of the things that I wanted to do was to look at class not through an adult author's eyes so much as through a young person's eyes. And this is, we're encountering Lucy, Lucy Lynch, one of the main characters of this book. He's now age 12, and he's in junior high school. And this is one of the first times that he encounters the whole issue of class. He doesn't think of it in those terms, but that's what he's musing about in the section that I'm going to read now. Everything about these Friday night dances was dramatic. Everyone was there. Not the black kids from the Hill, of course, but those of us with social currency to spend, a little or a lot. Even we ourselves didn't know how much, though we were learning. Since the doors stayed shut until 7 sharp, we were forced to mill about outside in the cold. In my memory, it's always winter, though the dances were held throughout the school year. Inside, up on the third floor, it was sweltering, the old gym packed to capacity with hundreds of jitterbugging 12- and 13-year-olds. Nothing in my previous experience of life in Thomaston so completely subverted the social order as those dances at the Y. And it was this very subversion that was at once so thrilling and terrifying. As we gathered outside, waiting for the doors to open, borough kids with other borough kids and East Enders and West Enders composing their own circles, the same rules that governed the school lunch table still applied. But there was also an electricity, a sense that once the doors opened and we clambered up those 6 dark flights of stairs, the air redolent of nearby locker rooms and chlorine from the basement pool, anything could happen. That our strict conventions were about to be suspended. Inside, we were in a new world that paralleled the old one, but was also thrillingly, dangerously off-kilter. There were secrets to be learned. And it was here we would learn them. The terrible anticipation began on the stairs when, if someone tripped or an adult appeared on the first landing in an attempt to slow the throng surging upward like water through the damaged hull of a ship, the stairway would jam, desire and anxiety and unbearable hope momentarily thwarted, delaying by eternities our emergence into the gym, into mystery itself, where the music, We could hear it there in the stairwell had already begun to play. Once, stalled in this fashion, I happened to look at the girl next to me, and when our eyes met, I saw that hers were full of tears. Possibly, she was simply afraid of being crushed. She'd been separated from her friends, and though we couldn't move forward, those below continued to press upward, causing everyone in the stairwell, our feet locked in place, to lean forward, our hands pressing for balance into the backs of those on the next higher step. In a matter of moments, we were stacked there like semi-toppled dominoes. That's one explanation. But I recognized this girl as a fellow East Ender, and I think now that her eyes had simply filled with pent-up anticipation. She was imagining her friends already upstairs dancing without her, getting so far ahead that she'd never catch up. By the time she joined them, the boy that she had been thinking about all week, whose eyes she had met across the crowded cafeteria, who was too popular, admit it, to be a realistic aspiration, would already be taken. We shared, all of us, a powerful sense that what was at stake on those crowded stairs was nothing less than the rest of our lives, that our every move in that gymnasium had an unimaginable significance, that we were being watched, judged, elected, and damned. Slow down, we were being told at home and at school. You've got your whole lives ahead of you. But to get stalled in that stairwell was to understand how little time there was and how fast it was wasting.
You're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Richard Russo, reading from his novel Bridge of Sighs. You know, Richard, one of the things that was really interested in kind of continuing the conversation about, you know, place and family and connections were these route men.
Yeah.
That you have in the book. And, you know, it really made me start thinking about the fact of that's a way to see how people see you. As Lucy's in the milk truck, as dad's a milkman.
Yeah.
And there's a next door neighbor who's a postal worker.
Right.
And, you know, you kind of keep traveling the same route. And I think that is something that smaller towns have that bigger cities don't necessarily, unless, you know, it's just within your own section, your own neighborhood.
Yeah.
And who waves back at you and who doesn't wave back at you. And I thought that was such a real and beautiful way to talk about class. And so I was wondering, you've been writing about class and work for a lot of years now. If there's things through your writing that you discovered that you were surprised at, that when you first started writing, you didn't think that way.
Well, you know, strangely enough, I think my whole interest in class kind of falls into that category. When I look back at my first couple of books, Mohawk and The Risk Pool, Mohawk contains a lot of the elements that are present even now, you know, a lot of years later in Bridge of Sighs. There's a creek polluting that town of Mohawk just as there is in this one. There's the first of my many cafes that will form the social center of the town. There were the very denizens to the very rich. Those things were all present in my novel Mohawk. But I don't think at the time that I wrote that book, I didn't think of myself as being interested. I hadn't identified that yet as an interest, class as an interest. I just thought I was writing about a bunch of very different people. You know, and I was kind of curious to look at all of them. And I think that just was my love of Dickens and my love of other writers who gave us a big canvas with which to work. My second novel, The Risk Pool, was a fairly simple father-son story, I thought. But it contained a lot of those same elements, too, right. the same small town, the same divisions. You know, here I am several novels later in which what's happened is that I've learned over really a very long period of time what I've been up to in those early novels. And so I thought to myself, all right, let's start with the geography of a town. Let's have right from the beginning an East End and a West End and an enchanted borough. Let's divide the town with, instead of Main Street, a division street. And let's let these people, according to what kind of work they do, prosper and fail, progress, regress. So, you know, something as simple as that, a writer's identity is in some ways the last thing to come sometimes. It's like tone and style. You can learn a lot of things in the early going, but somehow tone and style and a literary identity, as opposed to my own personal identity as
right.
as a father, as a husband, all of that. The real question is, who am I when I sit down in front of a blank piece of paper? That's kind of what I mean by a literary identity. And I don't know whether I'm a particularly slow learner or not, but it's been over the course of this several, you know, half dozen novels now that a lot of this stuff is fully coming home to me.
Well, believe it or not, Richard, we're at the end of our time. So I want to thank you so much for coming tonight.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Ben Cole and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio 91.3 WYEP.